Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Park.
This is Green and Red, and we're talking with legendary reporter Seymour Hersh. Mr. Hersh has won a Pulitzer Prize, a National Book Award, and several George Polk Awards. He's broken multiple important stories around military and national security matters, including Milei in Vietnam and Abu Ghraib in Iraq. And today we'll be talking about his bombshell article in Substack about the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline.
Thanks to Sagar for joining us. Really appreciate it. First off, you've really kind of stirred a hornet's nest here. So why, what's Nord Stream, and why was Joe Biden and the White House and the State Department and the Defense Department so concerned about it?
Well, I guess we have to start with the first what. Nord Stream was, as some of your audience may not know, because actually we can also talk about this later. There's been such a dearth of reporting by the mainstream press about the story I did, but not around the world. Very simply that the United States has always been concerned as part of the containment package we have about Russia containing the spread of communism. It's been concerned about the incredible richness of the Soviet Union has in gas and natural gas, methane gas and oil and other minerals. It's a country that's 13 time zones wide, a lot of raw stuff in it. And the concern has been, even starting in the Kennedy days, that when the Soviet Union began selling its natural gas to Europe. The concern has always been that Russia, those dirty, evil communists, were going to weaponize their gas. They're going to use their gas to get Germany to be favorable to them and to cut into the import of NATO. We, after World War II, I think one of the great things we did, a lot of stuff that was useless in after World War II. We fought bitterly against the rational government in India and Italy because we were afraid of communist influence. The same in of course, in Greece. These are all well-known messes we started in fear of Russia. But in Western Europe, that was also an impact. But Western Europe emerged from the war as governments similar to ours, the democracies, pluralism, economics, a lot of big industrial bases. And Germany was, of course, since it has spent more than a decade killing, raping, and murdering Europeans, really had a long way to go. And but it had become a good neighbor. Willy Brandt's Ostpolitik was a great notion. He was going to show Western Europe we're different. We're not the Nazis. We in Germany, we want to build things, make things, sell things to you cheaply, be good trading partners, and be accepted by you as a fellow member of Western Europe. And eventually, they got into NATO. Unified Germany became into NATO, and of course. One of the commitments we made then is we would not, Gorbachev allowed the merged Germany, East and West joined in 1990, I think. Before that, East Germany had been in the Soviet, the Warsaw Bloc, and the Russian Bloc. But now, all of a sudden, they're now part of NATO. And the deal that Gorbachev made with James Baker, our Secretary of State then in 1990, it's in the papers in the embassy, our embassy in Bonn. I had a friend of mine who knows German well, go read them in the original German and in English. We promised we would not expand NATO to the east if Gorbachev let East Germany meld it into the West as one into NATO, the new country, and he did. All right, that's some primitive history. And meanwhile, of course, we were always worried about communism. We were always worried about Kennedy had his thing with Khrushchev. There was always all sorts of longstanding debates. So the Johnson years, there were arms treaties made, but still, the Russian bear was somebody we're high on our hate list always. Communism was always a fear. And I'm sure there was tremendous competition after World War II. And a lot of it was justified. What Stalin did was as paranoid as anything we did after the war. Anyway, out of this emerged a longstanding worry about oil. And that as long as Russia could sell oil at cheap prices and gas, which it was doing, it had, as I said, it was viewed as weaponizing using their natural gases or their wonderful raw minerals and gases as a weapon. So Kennedy talked about it. It was big in the Cheney years. When Obama was president, Biden chaired a subcommittee or a major committee that in the Obama White House on the whole issue of Russian gas. There's a long history of it. And so disliking the fact that Russia was such a major influence in terms of making Europe warm and wealthy, that was always an issue. In 2011, the first of the two pipelines that was destroyed, Nord Stream 1, went into play. It was largely by Gazprom, 51%, which is a collection of Russian oligarchs. And of course, enormous amounts of the money they were making, and there was many, many hundreds of billions, really, was shoved back into the into Russia and the Russian treasury. 1 year, $45 billion alone was recovered after the pipeline went on. You can imagine how many hundreds of billions were being made. They were selling gas cheap. The pipeline, Nord Stream 1, went directly from Russia directly to Germany. There was so much gas that the German government was allowed to retail some of the gas, sell it itself downstream down to other companies at a profit. And Russia didn't, there was a lot of connection between Russia and Germany we didn't like, period. But the pipeline went, and a second one was built. Nord Stream 2 was completed in 2021, by which time there was a lot of tension about Ukraine. And as part of the tension and the rhetoric we were using against Russia, and Putin basically had the first pipeline shut down. And the second one was completed, ready to go in 2021. And at our request, the Germans sanctioned it. So Nord Stream 1 was shut down by Russia itself, by Putin. That was his power. And Nord Stream 2 was shut down by the German government, Scholz, who's the Chancellor of Germany. And so at that point, when it was shut down, it was in the fall. At that point, there were a lot of questions about we were having in Washington. The war was on. The war started a year ago this month. And by the summer, late summer, last fall, it was pretty clear, not to the American media, because I think the coverage by the mainstream press on the war has been pretty one-sided. And the people I know in the intelligence community, I've been around, for, 300 years as a reporter, for God's sakes. I actually started working for the New York Times in the early 70s, and the My Lai story I did was in 69. So I've been in the play on sort of big issues that long. And all that happened is that by late fall, even though it's not in the press, I've done a lot of work on it because it was blown up on September the 26th. By late fall of last year, at the best we could hope for was a stalemate in the Ukrainian war. And I will tell you right now, there was very little doubt among the people I know in the community, and I do know them not only here in other countries, American officials, but other country allies of ours, that the prognosis was bad. Putin has yet to put the hated Putin, the much hated Putin here, reviled in America, has yet to put his regular army in there. He's just using a group of ex-prisoners, the Wagner Group, a private group, and he's using some sort of the second string and a lot of artillery. Unlike the West, Russia, Putin, all of the weapons factories are state-owned. So he can do what he can get what he needs very quickly. We have to get a contract with a company and worry about the back end payments and negotiate it and then start a production line. So we're not able to turn around in terms of making more rockets as he is. So all this talk about shortage is just in the fantasy of the briefers who tell the press whatever they want to tell the press. And so and what happened, the story is that, about 3 months before the investigation, before the war began in February, began in late February, literally about this time, the 24th, I think, of February last year, the first overt attack. But we saw he was building up all last winter. We could see it. And he was going to go. I don't think there was any question, no matter how much we made threats. And so at that time, Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor for the president, who was always been a very strong, like everybody around Biden, very, very anti-Russian, anti-communism. And even though Russia's no longer communist, Putin's not a communist. But he's in his own way. This is not romantic what he's doing. He sees himself as recreating the Russia of old, you know, the Peter of Great stuff and what you will. You know, Russia is still going to be is a dominant force, and he wants to make sure it is. He's got his own fantasies going too, but he certainly didn't like the fact that we cheated on the agreement we made in 1990 when Gorbachev made an agreement. The deal was that they would not expand NATO to the east. NATO now has what, 29, 30 countries, when initially it was only Western Europe. And now we have, Moldavia, Romania, the countries in it that, you know, have nothing to do with what happened in Western Europe with the Germans. It's been expanded. And so Biden obviously looking for leverage on the Russians, on Putin to keep him from going, the threats and et cetera. He asked Jake Sullivan, I can't say I know that. All I know is Jake Sullivan set up a little team, an interagency team. I don't know the title. CIA, NSA, State Department, the usual suspects, Treasury, the Joint Chiefs, would to meet in a secure place in Washington, the Executive Office Building next to the White House, which is in the same compound. There's a walkway and an underground walkway. Most of the offices of the lesser officials are in the Executive Office Building, the deputies, not necessarily the first stringers, but they met there. Beginning in before Christmas of 2021, with the war just building up, by then pretty close, they were already close to 100,000 troops on the way or in Belarus. It was going to happen, and the idea was come up with something that can hold off the Russians, some threat. And I used the term of art that the words that were used by the group. I'm very cagey about sources. I describe. My information is coming from somebody with knowledge about it. I just have to be, and so a lot of criticism about that. I'm not naming names. Of course, they'd all be in the gulag, our version of a gulag. I don't think our prisons are. Some of our prisons don't meet international standards. I'll tell you that, particularly in the South. Anyway. They met, and the question was, does the president want recommendations that are reversible or irreversible? And reversible, we're talking about sanctions. Irreversible, we're talking about something kinetic. And by after the first of the year, after a few meetings, it was quite clear the option was kinetic. And the one option that made sense was the one thing Putin had going for himself with Western Europe and Germany in terms of a connection was the pipeline. And this is something that has been on the books for 50 years. Worry about the Russian connection. I'm going to be writing about it later. I know I've done a lot of research. I've actually found people who have done the research who know about it. There's been a lot written about the longstanding hostility of we've had to Russian natural minerals and gases, just in terms of Cold War deals.
Hey, folks, you're listening to the Green and Red podcast. Our interview with legendary reporter Seymour Hersh.
And as always, we thank you for listening, and we hope you continue to subscribe and share on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. You can follow us on social media, and you can also donate to Green and Red. And we have a great group of people who have been supporting us. And to do that, you can, Scott.
Yeah, just check out our website at greenandredpodcast.org and hit the support button, or go to Patreon, become a patron at patreon.com/greenandredpodcast.
And so by mid-January, it was decided they could do something to the pipelines if you wanted. That would be the one thing you could do. If you knocked out the first pipeline was already stopped by Putin. He pretended in the year earlier, 6 months earlier, in 91, he'd said there was a pump trouble and we had to shut it down. But that was punishment for our rhetoric, which was already increasing. And for the clear support we were going to have for Ukraine, which Russians have always seen Ukraine as a buffer, particularly since we expanded NATO. It's a big country, and it basically provides a protection. And also, Russia's seen the Ukrainians as sort of subculture. If you know your history, and I'm sure some of you do, in the early 1930s, there was a famine, and Stalin in the Ukraine, in the great wheat fields, and Stalin took the wheat away. 22 million Ukrainians starved to death because they couldn't, you know, I mean, it's always been treated as I say. And so they told the White House in January is the time that I conclude that they had a way. They could do it. They could do something covertly. And then within a week or two of telling them that, to the horror, I should say that, I don't know, to the dismay of those involved in planning this, both the Undersecretary of State, Victoria Nuland, and Biden both bragged about what they had. Maybe that was their idea all along, to say we have this capability and stop. They thought it would stop Russia, Putin, but there was no stopping. I don't think so. Putin said, we know we can stop Nord Stream 2. One was already gone, but number two had been sanctioned by Germany. We can stop it. We can prevent it from coming in by one means or another. And 2 weeks later, with the Chancellor of Germany next to him, Biden went on with the same bit. And he said, and in response to a question, he said, well, they'll have trouble with Nord Stream if they attack. And what do you mean, a reporter asked. We know how to take it out. And we will do it, he said. Those two conversations, I must tell you, since I've done my piece, which depended very much on those two conversations in terms of the impact on the group planning, I have disappeared from the argot of the mainstream newspapers. Just not mentioned anymore. It's forgotten. I can't think of any more reason that once I found that quote, I realized that the information I was getting really was true. I mean, I started looking into this. Well, anyway, what happened is the war started. The team kept on working. They went to Norway, as I've written about. I've also written a story. That was my first story about NORDFLC. I wrote a story. I write once a week. I'm doing one tomorrow, too. Stuff about still relevant, I think, for my Substack people. It's a funny operation, but it's amazing. I'm self-publishing. In other words, I have to hire
an editor. We both subscribe, yeah.
Yeah, well, the point being that they started their project, and these are people who are in the business of doing things and doing it with as few people knowledgeable as possible. And they worked with Norway. And one of the pieces I wrote after I did the story was all about what Norway had done for us in North Vietnam before.
I wasn't aware of that. Yeah.
And by the way, I've since learned it was much more than I knew. I mean, you know, they were hitting sites way deep inside Russia with Navy SEALs. This is before the Johnson declared the Tonkin Gulf resolution. We were really provoking them. And the premise for Johnson getting permission to do what he wanted in the war from the Congress was a lie. And that there's obviously parallel to what's going on now. That, I think, pretty obvious to me anyway. So these guys did their job. Very secretly, they did work in Norway, and they found the right divers to go in. They had to work. The Norwegians know they're great seamen. 1,400 miles of coastline along the Atlantic. They go from almost practically European Oslo, the capital, which is in the heart of the Baltic area, Sweden and Norway, part of Europe, 1,400 miles into the Arctic Circle, where they run into Russia. And we have, for the last decade, I've spent, I'm sure it's more than a billion, but I just said hundreds of millions. It's who's counting at that point. We've rebuilt up north, close to the Russia, in Norwegian territory. We've revamped the World War II submarine base that we now operate, expanded the airfields and a Navy base there, and built the most advanced radar systems you can build up there to monitor Russian. There's a peninsula up there, the Kola Peninsula, over the mountains, where the Russians have a big missile site. Their ICABMs, and we have tremendous coverage. It's and so Norway's become a major partner of ours in our anti-Soviet activities. We run reconnaissance flights. They run them with us on the North Sea, on the bases in the north, up north there. The Russians have anyway. We do the same. Russia goes all the way east to Vladivostok, where we do the same kind of spying, and they do the same kind of spying too. There's nothing original about it. Airplane patrols, satellite patrols. And anyway, it's not quite a war footing, but it's pretty close. So they found a way to do it in May with cover. They found the divers. They went to a very interesting place in Panama City, Florida, where nobody, I can't imagine a place I would rather spend less time. It's 70 miles from the Georgia border and 100 miles from Tallahassee. It's really in the middle of nowhere, but it's also on the Gulf of Mexico, where there's great sword fishing stuff. There's a lot of fishing there anyway. And so they got it done. They did, the war started. They still did their work. They got the divers. They got bombs planted on all the pipelines. They run parallel to each other, and they each have two. Each of the pipelines are, they're steel pipes, two on each side, Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2, covered by a concrete, so they can, no water gets around the steel, and so obviously the salinity in the water, not as much. It's much less salty than the Atlantic Ocean, the Baltic Sea, but it's a big sea. Full of pollution and full of a lot of codfish and a lot of travel, a lot of commerce. And we have a presence there, NATO presence there, major. It's Russia monitors it too. It's way up there. And it was supposed to take place. The bombing was supposed to take place initially, was going to happen in May or June when there was an exercise going on. NATO had an exercise going on. And they, you know, one thing about divers and the Baltic Sea, there's no oil there. So there's no oil rigs. So there's nobody diving. And so that was a problem. But they worked it all out. And they were ready to go. And the president changed his mind at the last minute. The war had been on 4 months by June when there was an exercise, a NATO exercise in late May and June. And that served as a cover for them to have divers go down and plant the stuff. But he threw a monkey wrench into it because he wanted it to be fixed so they could go off at any time, the bombs, which is a complicated problem because you're dealing with a sonars triggering low frequency beams. It sounds, actually, all it is sounds. It's so interesting how it works. When you were a kid, I'm sure you had a game where if you were playing, you know, age of 9 or 10 with girls and horsing around, to get into a closed door, you'd go. You have little. That's all it is. That's what they. That's how they trigger it. A series of. Somebody compared it. I talked to some scientists about the problem. High frequency gets burned up by the water. Low frequency could go in, and you can replicate the sound, and trigger a bomb. Somebody said it's like playing a flute too. You could the same sort of tonal sound. So that if leaving it underwater for an indefinite period of time, as the White House wanted, was a big problem for them, because the whole idea was to deter the Russians. And what are they doing now? What's his game plan? And so they did do it. They did what he wanted. They put the mines there. And it was not until late September, the 26th, almost three and three quarters months later, that the president said, now's the time to bomb. And the bombs went off. One set didn't go off. Well, part of one of the two pipelines on Nord Stream 2 is intact, but the other pipelines were destroyed. It was a huge mystery. And everybody since September, who did it? You know, and we initially talked a lot about Russia doing it, et cetera, et cetera. And so it struck me as a mystery too. And in October, I'm doing another long project, and I know people, and I was seeing somebody in that world. And I said, what's going on with Nord Stream? What was that all about? And the person said, well, of course we blew it. Pissed off a lot of people in the community because we didn't understand what his game was. Why would you want to take out a pipeline that had been stopped by the Germans? They had control of it, but winter was coming. And the gas that the Nord Stream 1 had provided had turned Germany into an industrial behemoth. The largest chemical company, BASF, in the world is there. Mercedes, and you know, all the German cars that are so successful here and around the world. Industrial basis. And so much gas. and so cheap that Germany became a roaring, you know, a very mercantile. And you're taking away the ability of Germany to decide its fate. Why would Biden want to do that? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, I've looked at late September. I think late December is by the time, despite what you read, as I said earlier, that it looked like at best a stalemate. He was worried, appropriately, but Germany after World War II was not interested in rearming, and he wanted more money. I think the number, it's scores of billions have been put in there, into basically a throwaway, without getting into the merits of the independence of Ukraine and the rights of us to have a country we want, that separating that issue out. What he did was he told, you know, we've had Germany and Western Europe's back. There's no natural resources there. There's no gas and oil. We've had their back since World War II. And you could count on us. We supported NATO. Trump came in and was worried about the fact that most of the European countries weren't paying their 2% dues as they were supposed to, 2% of their gross national income, or whatever it is, something like that. And we didn't care. We just always supported NATO with all of its flaws. And we supported all of Western Europe. The only good thing that we did out of Western Europe was rebuilding the countries there into these great, wonderful places we go to visit, democracies, et cetera, et cetera. And so right now, what interests me about the story is having worked, let's see, at the New Yorker for many years and at the New York Times, and having published stories at the New York Times about the CIA doing all sorts of stuff against Chile, against our own people, domestic spying, led the congressional hearings, never with the name source. And all of a sudden now, there's a concern in those papers that I'm not naming a source. And as somebody said to me about the story, given what Biden and the Undersecretary Victoria Nuland said earlier, I have an old friend of mine in the oil business in Europe, who wrote me after the first story, and he said, Cy, he said, you have become the master of deconstructing the obvious. So there you are. The story gets out. I can tell you there was more than 1 million hits within a day on it. And Substack's interesting because the people who take Substack, you have to pay. The story I did was free, but if you want to keep on reading me, you have to pay $5 something a month or something like that. It's not a gouging price, but obviously this is my work now. And the people that what I get constantly are emails saying, what's happened to journalism? You know, a lot of people don't buy. Look, I know it was tough for the Democrats in the Trump years, and I know we ended up with there's Fox News on one side and CNN and NSBC on the other side, NSNBC on the other side. And I know the newspapers were ecstatic that Biden, a Democrat, whatever his flaws, won. But at this point, we're still playing that game where it seems to be where if the story I'm writing apparently favors Putin, as it does, because Putin, the idea that I will tell you inside the industry, I've told this to a bunch of reporters. Before I wrote that, published that story, I knew in ways I could not make public because I get people writing me private stuff. I knew that the guys in the pipeline construction business, and it's a big business now, pipelines, there's more than 12,000 miles of pipelines now. The law about blowing up a pipeline is unsettled. There is law saying you can't blow up an underground communication line, but there's no law about it. I mean, in other words, if there was a trial about it, I'm sure any court would rule this was a war crime, blowing up a pipeline when there's no immediate need. But it's not on the books yet. But anyway, for a lot of reasons, I'm trying to tell people that's where to go. The story's there. I knew that before I wrote it off one source, that it was also in the community. But I knew it from inside. So I couldn't say that. But it's there. In the pipeline business, they all thought right away, of course it wasn't Russia. Yeah. Why would Russia? And by the way, the Russians right now, They have an estimate of, I think, $1.5 billion to fix it up. They paid hundreds of, a Swiss company got more than $100 million to do a very good estimate of what it would cost to repair it, the pipeline, which they might not do because salt water has corroded, everything. And there's no more any, they have to rebuild the whole thing. I don't know what they'll do. Russia may do it. Certainly not in the wartime conditions you have now.
Yeah.
So there you are. You have my soliloquy. Fire away.
I've seen some of people using open source stuff, kind of take you on with regard to the logistics, the timeline, the technology. What do you think of that and how would you respond to that?
Oh, yeah. That was in the first week or so. There was quite a bit of that.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you what's interesting to me. When Biden flew to Poland before taking the train to go see Zelensky, that famous visit, Biden's completely invested in this.
Yeah.
Completely invested in Ukraine, down the line, all the way. I don't know what the end game is going to be, but he's completely invested. And so are his supporters in the media, too, in the Congress. You haven't seen Chuck Schumer, head of the Senate, with a plurality in the Senate, asking for an investigation into this. They've been so quiet, the Democrats. This is an issue that doesn't help in the next election. So when he flew there, the account I saw in the New York Times, I think, but I read both the New York Times and Washington Post. I look at the Wall Street Journal online, but I get the paper. I'm one of those. When I was at the New York Times, the print circulation was 1.7 million. Now it's about 320 or 30,000 because they're making all their money online. They have all these different departments. It's become sort of a money-making institution. Anyway, they're doing well. But not because of the newspaper business, because of all the other things they offer, podcasts and what you will, like you guys have. But anyway, so when he flew, according to the newspaper account he read, because when they got in Poland, where there's a danger, it was a tricky place. There's an awful lot of arms that were sent to the Ukrainian war that have been peddled by various officers in the Ukrainian military and what they call the dark web. The dark web. They sold a lot of some of the anti-aircraft handheld stuff can knock down a plane at 20,000 feet. There's a lot of worry about what we've been selling. What these guys, generals, and the people in the community in Ukraine have been peddling. In any case, it said it turned off its transponder. All airplanes have an IFF signal, beep, 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 that lets everybody else know where they are. You can't, it's against the rules. They turned off the transponder. And so the OSINT people say, there's no plane. What OSINT does, and it's useful, we're talking about open source intelligence. It's always been a major part of the NSA. I have a friend there, and 40 years ago, a friend of mine in his house showed me what he could do with OSINT. It was the hot stuff. Maybe it was even more. It would have been in the 80s or late 70s. Showed me in his house in rural Virginia. He found the 1954 parking ticket I had in Chicago.
Wow.
And when I was a student there. Yeah. How about that? Had an old Ford convertible, and I used to drink a lot, and I ruined the car because when you're kids, you do dumb stuff. I'd leave it with the top down. And the next day or 2 days later, when I recovered from my bout of booze, there'd be a big storm and there'd be 2 pounds of water in it. I ruined that car so quickly, stupidly. Education is wasted a lot on the young. I find a lot of your students will tell you they began really seriously reading maybe three or four years out.
Yeah,
I did. I did an awful lot of reading when I was out of college.
Yeah,
my first 10 years out. Anyway, so they all say that no such plane could have flown. Well, they could have taken off the transponder. And the other thing is, OSINT, they don't see anything. It's all electric impulses. And ships have their own way of, in a crisis, they report, they can get in communication with any group, and they have their own serial number. So when they have an emergency number, they turn on their, they have communications they have, but for an emergency, they have their version of a 911, and they have to punch in their serial number, their locator. But there's nothing that says they have to punch in the right one. And there's nothing so if you're a bunch of smart guys in the CIA with NSA, National Security Agency, SIG input, you can recreate anything you want. You could invest and you want to do it, or you want OSINT to provide a cover for what you're doing. your plane's going to go in without a transponder, but you're going to have a lot of other planes using it. And you're also, you can recreate, I'm not kidding, you can create a Japanese World War II armada, you know, a midway sort of striking force.
Yeah.
You could do anything you want with by just simply creating signals that go out. And you know, you know what the OSIN people are looking at. And so what they actually did is they did create a whole series of ships. They keep on saying that the ship I said that had done it, Alta Class, it was a Norwegian ship, wasn't there that day. Well, you know, all you'd have to do is just invent other, you know, have different signposts, sign in with different numbers. It's not like a transponder. There's more flexibility in their reporting system. And all you have to do is invent other ships there. And what they actually used for communication was the same use that the president, in the, it was written about. The president had what they call an RC-135. It's a rivet joint. They had it's a Boeing 707 converted by the National Security Agency and the Air Force into a radar collector. And they fly those high, and they collect radar signals, et cetera. They're intelligence planes, but they diverted one to fly over the president when he was visiting Zelensky, because it's a very serious unable to deviate or break into communication system in case there's a crisis. They had one up when the guys did the bombing, and so everything else was up for play. And you invent whatever you want there. I mean, it's so easy to explain, but it's so hard for the OSIN guys to want to accept that. Because, you know, for them, a signal is a signal. But it's very simple to recreate a different world for them. And it's part of the cover. It's something they actually plan and do.
Of course.
Because if you confuse the people, you don't know who's doing what. Anyway, yeah. So there you are. Keep on going.
One question I have is, you know, thinking about the media in the 70s, but then we also had in Congress, we had, you know, a Congress that took these things serious and led all sorts of investigations. And, you know, the church committee is like the most obvious example. And then what we have today is we have Jim Jordan, who's saying he's going to bring back, you know, it's going to be the Church Committee 2.0 or something along those lines. And I'm kind of curious, since the Republicans are in the House, if you have had, you know, been hearing from that, are they interested in investigating this? Is there been any talk of that? It seems like they're pretty quiet on Nord Stream, but I'm just kind of curious about that.
Well, this is a tremendous amount of anti-Russian feeling in America right now, anti-Putin feeling. It's really... I have a friend that went, they had their annual National Day event the other day. They had an open house they've had. I remember in years past when I was at the Times, I went a couple of times because the food was great. When the issue was the problems inside America, what we were doing in the 70s in Vietnam. And Russia then was working, remember signing peace treaties with us and actually cutting off Vietnam, as did China. And so I remember going to events there. Somebody told me he was the only American at an event there, one of the National Day events the other week. We've made it, we turned Putin into pariah. You know, we like our Hitlers. We have a long list of Hitlers, you know, everybody's been Hitler. The guy Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, you know, and Assad in Syria, they've all become Hitlers for us. Putin's a nice one for us, even though the Russian Empire is gone. He's a Hitler. And so Congress, I think part of the shakedown, as I said at the beginning, because of Trump and the hostility, in Vietnam, the Democrats were all again, ended up turning on the war. So did many of the moderate Republicans. In 1973, there was a War Powers Act that prohibited the president from using force in Vietnam. Was in the spring of 73. It was a big blow to the White House. Nixon was still in. He had to get permission from Congress to re-engage militarily in Vietnam, which I think he would have done otherwise. I don't know. He had Watergate going too. And that was the guy who wrote the major player was a Republican senator from Tennessee or one of the states, one of those middle Atlantic states or middle Southern states. And so it's a whole different atmosphere. Now, as I said, there's 52 members of the Democrats and Chuck Schumer. There hasn't been a word said about what Biden's done, about the issue I raised. They haven't said, we're going to look into it. this guy Hirsch is raising stuff. The New York Times hasn't written a word about it. There were demonstrations last weekend in Berlin, and the Germans take this seriously because for them not to have the ability to go back and open up Nord Stream 2. Europe got away this year. It's been bad, but not nearly as bad as it could have been because of the climate change. It's much warmer there. And Germany is a very frugal. They have money bankroll. They've been bailing out the increase in heating costs. They've been paying 15% to 20% subsidies to everybody involved to try and mitigate the costs. And it has been mild. So it's been politically bad. Germany's had the least of it. In Italy, they're paying 3 and 4 times the cost of fuel. In France, I have friends that are paying 5 times the cost for electricity. Gas is used to drive the turbines that create the electricity. Everybody's pulled away from coal and nuclear now. And so the prognosis isn't very good for in economic growth. The largest company I mentioned, the BASF, is employees. And it's now talking to China about moving some of its, it's the largest chemical plant in the world. I'm interested in it because they've been talking to the Chinese about maybe putting some plants there where they can be assured of gas. Large bakeries that had 12 ovens going, commercial bakeries now are only running 3 or 4 because the cost of gas is more. It's not that much more, but it's enough so that takes the edge off profits. Electricity per kilowatt is pretty much stable. But it's in a lot of it's still on the curve is slightly up, and any increase in costs is a reduction of profits, and they're never going to have the odds are very high the winter next year will be harsh, and then they're in real trouble. And so Europe is concerned, Germany's concerned. They had demonstrations Saturday against the war, not about the pipeline primarily. There was a lot of concern about the story I wrote there too. Obviously the papers were all, they also hate Russia too. They have a big division there. Most of the press is anti-Russian, and most of the American press is totally. I mean, it's completely anti-Russian. It's just, I mean, if you're reading the coverage in my old newspaper of the war, I can't believe some of the stuff. When I went there, you couldn't say things about even the Khrushchev that we were saying now about, you know, and they keep on writing attacked. Khrushchev attacked Ukraine without justification. Well, no, there have been 31 years of lying about the expansion of NATO. And also in 2014, there was no question, there was an overthrow of the government there. The pro-Soviet government was overthrown by us, largely. I mean, that's clear. Everybody knows that happened. And then there were a series of accords that was going to control the ongoing dispute in the Donbas region. It's provinces that were very close to Russia, but also in Ukraine. And I don't think there's any question that the Minsk Accords were violated much more by Ukraine than by Russia. Overwhelming percentage of the shelling and bombing that was going on was done by the Ukrainian forces. I don't think there's any, it's totally empirical data. You just don't hear those stories. And doesn't defend what Putin did. He's the first guy to start a war. Yeah, he started the bloodiest war in modern Europe, in Western Europe, since World War II. I mean, they had the Balkan thing, that's also part of Europe, and they had stuff in Chechnya, but nothing's been as bloody as what's happening there. That'll always be on his record forever. So there's no mercy for him on that. But still, it wasn't unprovoked. And then the language. I think I've had people make the argument to me, Americans in the intelligence community, that one of the problems we did by increasing the rhetoric on Putin is giving him the public support he needed. You know, I've been to Russia in the last 4 or 5 years. It's so much more open than it used to be. Beautiful Western, tremendous Western influence. I stayed in a Western controlled, fancy Western hotel. The restaurants are incredible, like they never, the Eurasian, every once people knew I was an American, just walking on the street, they would say, oh, we love your country. And, you know, so nice to see you, so much warmth about it. And in private conversations with everybody, it was nothing but heated criticism of Putin. The same kind you get here, if you have dinner with a bunch of Democrats and the Republicans in, or, you know, it's the same kind of he's, you know, what a son of a bitch he is. You hear all that kind of stuff, but they're still there and they're making a living and they're trading with the West, and why he wanted to throw it over. But on the other hand, Biden's rhetoric about him, which is politically useful for him up to a point, I think I noticed the polls show support in America for the Ukraine war dwindling. There wasn't a chance he could have pulled off that war without enormous resentment by the population, which is prosperous, trading with the West and all that stuff. And by the time we got done yapping at him, he went from about, I don't know the numbers, he went from a number that wasn't sustainable to 70-80% support. And so you can almost, it was made, this is what he, in the intelligence community said to me, we basically enabled him with the rhetoric. They're a very strange White House.
Yeah.
You know, they're good on social programs, but
that's kind of what happened with Saddam in Iraq. You know, with the sanctions, he was able to use that to mobilize, you know, support. Let me just ask you to go back to Germany for a second, because I keep wondering why September, you know, why pick that date in September? And after reading the article,
It was September the 26th. He did it.
Right. But does Germany, I think it seems like after reading what you wrote, that Germany has something to do with that, that this is actually a signal directed to Berlin.
There was growing resentment in Germany about all the economic demands we were making on them to support the war. And also from other allies in Western Europe and NATO allies, there was a sense that this isn't their war. There was growing resentment. But I think the real fear was even deeper. It goes back to the historical post-war, Cold War worry about Russia weaponizing gas. That has been a theme. I'm going to write about it eventually. It's much more of a theme than I knew when I started this. I mean, it really goes back 50 years, 60 years. Just a great worry in the going back to the Kennedy Khrushchev days and that stuff. And it just was an issue that they did. Germany always was in much more friendly and trading much more with Russia than we liked all during the post-war period. And so that was always a problem. Germany was marching to its own drummer on this, on economic stuff. And it is interesting to me. So late September is the time I fix from people who know more about the war than I do, when it was clear to this White House, despite all the you know, all the stuff we get about, you know, reporters, you know, reporters don't like the when the I did Mila as an outsider. I wasn't there. And I understand that if I'd been there as a correspondent, I went to North Vietnam later. And when you go to those countries, you're totally dependent on the communications they have and the protection they have. So if you're a reporter in the Vietnam War working against the dirty commies, the Viet Cong and North Vietnam, you're working with the Americans. They're flying you in their choppers. They're giving you cover. In a crisis, you can get on a command net and file a story back to Washington. I'm serious. You can get on a command net and do it if you talk fast. Yeah. And we had always had, there was a cable company. Reuters was the main cable company that you could always file on. And so you were totally dependent on us. So if you saw some awful stuff, you tended not to write it. So I do understand that. A lot of reporters knew about My Lies. Not that one, but smaller ones.
Yeah.
And they didn't do it. And that happened in the Gulf War, too, when the reporters with them, what was the word that was used? They put reporters in with the American units going in.
Embedded
them. And I talked to reporters who told me embedded with a group in the second or third day driving up from Kuwait into Baghdad when they were worried about, you know, getting into combat. There'd be a car going along a road them, and they would signal it to stop. You know, they were at an intersection, and there was a car next to them that was driving by, and they would go out and in English say, hey, stop. Or they used I think Dung Hai. There was a phrase they all used in Vietnam to tell people to stop running away from them. Are you kidding? You'd run away from the Americans so fast in Vietnam after a certain point.
Yeah.
And so they opened up. One reporter was on the second day was with a unit, tank unit that opened up on a car, and they killed a mother, father, and 3 or 4 kids, and didn't write it because he said they were good guys. You know, that's the problem with embedding too. So all I can tell you is that we're going down a very bad road here with the Biden administration, not only towards Russia, but towards China.
Yeah.
I don't know what the game is. I think maybe, I don't know what the, I think the president's, I mean, I thought the president's trip to Luzhensky, it doesn't matter what I thought, but there were people I know that thought it was, they're thieves. That country is very corrupt. And Zelensky's part of it. And there's always been pressure between him and the generals about who's taking how much share. I will tell you that. That's pretty astonishing what I'm telling you. There's been issues about how much he's taking, how much the generals are getting. It's pretty amazing. That's really what's going on. I mean, that's on one level. Another level, he's what he seems to be. You know, a great patriot who's willing to fight this war that he's going to lose to the last Ukrainian. I think the war is going much worse for the Ukrainians than the American press is telling you. In fact, I've told that, but that doesn't make it true.
Since the story's broken, have you been getting flooded with people who said, yeah, there's even more to it than that?
I've told reporters that you've got to, you, if you want to find American reporters that I know, I said, call up the companies that build pipelines. There's an American company. Call them and just, you know, you might have to get it off the record. You know, that's the problem. Because anybody in the construction business wants to keep their mouth shut. Because, you know, you just can't. The Russians build a lot of pipelines. You'll take a contract from them tomorrow.
But you think there's more of this that we're going to find out? The story is still
well, not about... I know a lot more than I wrote because only it's the details. The gross story won't change much. He did it. I don't know exactly why he did it. It's a fair assumption to make. I don't think the White House is ever going to be able to say they did it. They just can't do that because some people consider it an act of war, but because it'll really shatter. It's already what's happened has already shattered a lot of trust that the Western Europe has. We've always had the back of Western Europe. We've always helped them out. We've been there. And the president just threw that away. He said, I'm going to, just in case you lose your nerve and decide you don't want to support me and Ukraine anymore, and you want to go stop having gas come in because you want to keep your people warm, politician would, I'm going to blow up the pipeline so you can't do that. That's the only reason. That's why the people who did it are very upset too, because they really felt used. You know, in that story I wrote, I mentioned about, I did a piece about these CIA spying on the American citizens with seven unnamed sources for the New York Times, unnamed. And it started a big fight that led to the church hearings, the first hearings looking at the CIA. And I don't think anybody wants an investigation now of what Biden did. Anyway, Mr. Buzanko, I loved your book. As you said, I endorsed it. I don't remember doing it, but I remember reading it. And you had a good point of view about it. You know, the whole, you went back to scratch on it. And that was a good thing to do academically. So it stands you instead, that book, doesn't it?
Yeah. I remember, you know, when Cambridge told me you had blurbed it, I was one of the great thrills of my academic life. So I'd always, you know, been following your work and admired it. So.
I just thought you were writing from the beginning, which was very smart and very, and you know, you couldn't read that book and conclude like anybody where we are and how we screwed it up.
Hey folks, that was legendary reporter Seymour Hersh talking about his bombshell article on the bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline. If you like what you're hearing, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If you're watching on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you want to become a donor, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that support button. Or if you want to become a patron, go to patreon.com/greenandredpodcast. And everyone else, make trouble in this bandage.